Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey everyone, it's Matt Katz in for Tanzina, and today on The Takeaway, we've heard a lot of relief ideas for COVID-19's economic destruction, but not a lot of ideas on homelessness and how we help to fix that issue.
We can make a real change in what poverty and homelessness looks like in this city if we can get people into housing rather than putting them in temporary shelters or sending them back out onto the streets.
Also on the show, while most of the country is suffering financially, some billionaires have been making many more billions and billions.
Really, this has been all about a larger divergence between the wealthy and the poor.
Plus, we check back in on the restaurant industry. As the weather gets colder, how will dine-in options survive into 2020? Let's get going. As you know, the COVID-19 crisis has not just been a health crisis, it's been an economic crisis too. And as economic crises arise, so does unemployment and homelessness. In the years following the 2008 economic collapse, major cities saw a dramatic rise in the number of people experiencing homelessness. And now, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, we're seeing a rising rate of evictions. According to the Eviction Lab, in 17 cities that they tracked, there have been more than 53,000 evictions since the pandemic began. That results in not just homeless men on the street, but children living in shelters, families living in their cars in Walmart parking lots, people crowding into friends' or relatives' shared rooms. This period of time since the COVID-19 pandemic hasn't just exacerbated the problem, it's also given rise to a kind of grassroots activism against it. Earlier this year, amid the national uprisings for racial justice against police brutality, anti-homelessness activists have been playing an increasingly public role. In cities like Minneapolis and Philadelphia, activists have established homeless encampments and protected them from law enforcement sweeps that displace the camps. I'm joined now by Will James, reporter with KNKX Public Radio in Washington and host of the Outsiders podcast about homelessness in Olympia. Great to have you here, Will.
Yeah, hey, Matt. Thanks.
And we're also on the line with Anna Orso, a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer, who has been reporting on a homeless encampment slash protest in Center City, Philadelphia. Anna, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, guys, let's start with you, Will. You've been following the homelessness crisis throughout the West Coast. Can you just give us a picture to start of what this crisis looked like before the pandemic hit?
Yeah, so just take Washington State, for example. We have an estimated 21,000 people who are homeless in Washington State. And on the West Coast, what kind of distinguishes the West Coast from the East Coast when it comes to homeless is the proportion of people who are homeless who are living outside, who are unsheltered, who are living in tents, in the woods, and on the sides of highways. By some accounts, all the numbers on homelessness are a little bit shaky, very hard to get a solid number on them, but as many as two-thirds of people who are unsheltered and homeless in the United States live in California, Oregon, and Washington. So homelessness has been a very visible crisis, impossible to ignore on the West Coast. Vast encampments of people living in city downtowns and in parks. And before COVID-19, homelessness was the front and center issue in so many West Coast cities. It was getting a lot of attention. There was a ton of advocacy. It was, in every city council meeting, every county council meeting. Now, homelessness is one of many emergencies that states and cities and counties are dealing with. And so we're seeing advocates fighting for attention for this issue in a way that really hasn't been necessary in past years.
How are they fighting for attention? What does that look like?
It looks like kind of trying to use the media, show up at city council meetings and government meetings, and just kind of reminding people in power that even though there are so many crises that we're dealing with right now, this homelessness emergency hasn't gone away. In fact, much of the West Coast, many of the cities on the West Coast were in an official state of emergency around homelessness before this began. And so COVID-19 is actually, a state of emergency on top of a state of emergency in many of these cities.
Wow. Anna, tell us what's going on in Philly. There have been a couple of homeless encampments around for months, but they apparently double as protest movements, right? Can you explain a bit about what these look like and what they're like?
Yeah, you know, for Philadelphia, it's sort of a new and unique structure. We have had encampments of homeless folks for several years now that have grown in size and in prominence, and the city has, you know, swept them, cleared them out, and then people scatter and eventually regather somewhere else. Now, in the past couple of years, they've really been concentrated in the city's Kensington neighborhood, which is a couple miles away from Center City and from where, you know, media and politicians sort of do their everyday work. Now, the largest encampment of homeless folks, which was organized in June by affordable housing advocates, is on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, which is a very prominent space sort of in the middle of the city. It's where the famous art museum is located. It's surrounded by luxury condos, and it's really in a place that is impossible to ignore. And so we now have this interesting confluence of the racial justice movement mixed with the movement for affordable housing for people living in homelessness. And so it's presenting the city with this really new and interesting challenge, because they just can't handle this encampment like they have others in the past.
Are they making a connection between racial justice, the Black Lives Matter movements, and homeless activism? Are they making a connection there?
Very much so. The encampment was established 2 weeks into, you know, the racial justice protests here in Philadelphia, and it was immediately tied to Black Lives Matter. The activists connect the criminal justice system and policing systems with poverty and homelessness. There are a lot of Black men and women who are living in this homeless encampment who have been in and out of the criminal justice system almost all of their lives. And the organizers of this encampment are saying, look, this is all connected. If we reform our policing systems to stop disproportionately impacting Black people in Philadelphia, we can make a, you know, a real change in what poverty and homelessness looks like in this city if we can get people into housing rather than putting them in temporary shelters or sending them back out onto the streets where, as the activists say, homelessness can be criminalized in a variety of ways, whether that's folks being charged for substance use, public drunkenness, the like. These systems really are sort of inextricably linked.
And how is the city handling this? Are they allowing this homeless encampment to just stay in the center of town? I understand there's also a second one near the Philadelphia Housing Authority's office. I imagine these folks can't stay living there in tents and whatnot for, you know, indefinitely.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. The city has given several eviction notices at this point for both encampments. You're right. There is a smaller encampment in North Philadelphia outside the Housing Authority, which runs public housing in the city. But so far, the people living there and the activists running these encampments have resisted these eviction notices in a variety of ways. A couple months ago, there was a federal lawsuit filed on behalf of the encampment residents claiming their First Amendment right to protest was being violated. And several weeks ago, the city put out a final eviction notice, and when outreach workers and police showed up early one morning at 7 o'clock, there were dozens of activists who had gathered to defend the camps with sticks, boogie boards, makeshift shields. And it just was very clear that a sweep of the encampment was going to be really ugly. And there was a ton of media there to capture what occurred. So outreach workers and police sort of stepped back, and no eviction has taken place yet. You know, the city and the activists are still sort of negotiating.
Will, you referred to a crisis on top of a crisis, COVID and homelessness. What types of resources have been available to the homeless during the pandemic? Have those resources just been depleted across the board?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to watch. You know, the coronavirus pandemic has affected the homelessness crisis in kind of a bunch of different ways. The first, obviously, is that it's forced millions of Americans to the brink of eviction. And we know from studies here in Washington State that eviction is a main driver of homelessness. Back in June, I think it was estimated that 250,000 people in Washington couldn't pay their rent, and they were only protected by a moratorium on evictions. So that's the main effect. But it's also the pandemic has scrambled the way that nonprofits and local governments deal with homelessness, because you know, early on, there was this fear that the thousands of people who are homeless on the West Coast and here in Washington State would be a vector for disease and would be especially vulnerable to the pandemic. You know, we know that people who are homeless have higher rates of chronic disease. A lot of people who are homeless have illnesses like COPD and emphysema and cancer that would make them vulnerable to COVID-19. And a lot of people who are homeless live in these or spend their days in these really crowded environments like shelters and day centers. So one thing that happened was, number one, shelters had to spread out their populations, and that reduced the capacity of shelters. So when you move beds 6 feet apart, some shelters had to cut their populations by, you know, as much as half in some cases. Also, what some governments and nonprofits did was that they started moving people from shelters into individual hotel rooms around Washington State. And that's been really interesting to watch because, you know, there's this idea in homelessness services called housing first. It's kind of the conventional wisdom is that when you put someone in a home, their other problems might be addiction or mental illness or physical illness or disability become much easier to deal with. And that's what anecdotally a lot of service providers found. Once they moved someone from a crowded congregant shelter into a hotel room, suddenly, you know, they were able to, you know, in some cases go into recovery for addiction, in some cases, you know, just manage their addiction better, in some cases just feel better. There were fewer fights, fewer conflicts between residents. People, you know, said they felt calmer staying in these hotel rooms. And now there's a big push in Washington State to say, hey, maybe when this pandemic is over, maybe we don't go back to the congregant shelters. Maybe we try to keep this model going in some way, keep people in individual rooms, whether it's buying hotels and using them permanently to house people, whether it's building some kind of dormitory style facility in the future. Huh. The big problem, of course, is that local governments and state governments have been gutted by the economic fallout of the pandemic. So yeah. The big question is, you know, that's a really expensive proposition that they're talking about. And is there going to be any kind of capacity to do that in the future?
And then you also have to convince neighbors to put up buildings, larger buildings to house the homeless, which is obviously another issue. And it gets to something that Anna mentioned earlier. She said that there were negotiations going on between the activists and the homeless in these encampments in Philadelphia and the city of Philadelphia. What are the negotiations about? Are they looking for this kind of housing that Will was referring to?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of similar. I see a lot of parallels, actually, with what Will is talking about with regard to folks being sort of fed up with the shelter system and feeling like they are healthier in a variety of ways when they have a sort of space to themselves. So the negotiations are sort of related to that. The activists want the city to release vacant city-owned property into a sort of land trust that the activists would control and then be able to dole out to sort of the most vulnerable people who are living in the encampments.
We'll be following these stories out of Washington and Philadelphia. Anna Orso, reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you so much for being here, Anna.
Thanks, Matt.
And Will James is a reporter with KNKX Public Radio in Washington, host of the Outsiders podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Will. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. Over the course of the pandemic, the restaurant industry is estimated to have lost roughly $148 billion in revenue. That's according to the National Restaurant Association. And many states and cities have been slow to allow restaurants to open back up for indoor dining because of the potential health risks. But the past 2 weeks have seen some notable developments on that front in different parts of the country. That includes New York City.
This is the first day when you'll start to have indoor dining again. Now, let's be clear. This is something that was worked on very carefully by the state and the city and will start at a low level 25% capacity.
Chicago.
Indoor capacity will expand from current 25% to 40%.
And most dramatically in Florida.
We are today moving into what we initially called phase three. And what that'll mean for the restaurants is that there will not be limitations from the state of Florida.
The return to indoor dining may feel like a financial necessity for many restaurant workers and owners, but the public safety concerns remain. A CDC study from mid-September found that adults who tested positive for COVID-19 were about twice as likely to have dined at a restaurant than those who tested negative. The study did not, I should note, say whether those respondents were more likely to have dined indoors. Here with me to discuss all of this is Khushbu Shah, Food & Wine Magazine's restaurant editor. Thanks for being here, Khushbu.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Carlos Frias, food editor for the Miami Herald. Hi there, Carlos.
Hey, Matt.
So we were just talking about Florida, Carlos. So as we noted, Florida Governor DeSantis is now allowing restaurants and bars to operate at full capacity. How was this announcement received, Carlos?
Pretty much with a lot of shock from restaurant owners. The announcement came down. It was signed after 4 p.m. on a Friday, a couple hours before the Miami Heat were to play in a playoff game. And 3 hours later, the owner of a Miami-based restaurant chain walked into one of his 24 restaurants and saw people standing shoulder to shoulder. And said it was scary.
Wow. Was this related to the Heat playing the Lakers, that the governor wanted to make sure that bars were able to take advantage of people coming in to watch the games?
I don't know. This was when they were playing the Celtics, and the restaurants, a couple guys, including a manager who spoke to me off the record, said, you know, we're getting this news 3 hours before this huge game where people are potentially going to want to go out, and yeah. All of a sudden we have these new rules. I was going to say there was a stretch of about 30 hours from when Miami-Dade said that it had some ideas about adjusting those rules. They had to ask the state of Florida to have less than 100% capacity. So in those 30 hours, restaurants weren't sure what to do, and there was confusion throughout South Florida.
Are there any safety protocols that the governor is implementing as he moves the restaurants to full capacity?
I mean, he says that safety measures remain in place, whatever those were before, but he also said that he was stopping municipalities from fining for not wearing masks. So in all sense, he's saying that any mask rules have no teeth anymore. Although Miami-Dade County has said that and Broward County too said that they do intend on still writing tickets and, you know, whenever the emergency order is sending those fines out. But it seems like such a it's taken the teeth out of that, what was once a law.
Yeah. Khushbu, this is very different from New York. How is indoor dining being rolled out in New York City?
There's a few more rules, thankfully. I think it's still a pretty dangerous prospect, but, you know, 25% capacity, at least 6 feet between tables, no seats at the bar, you know, restaurants need to close at midnight, HVAC systems and air purifiers need to be upgraded. And they're doing temperature checks and recording contact info, actually, for diners so that the city's contact tracers can get in touch with people if they need to.
What are you hearing from restaurant workers in New York about starting back up? Are they happy to be back at work and working more hours? Are they freaked out about the safety situation?
I think most of them are more freaked out than anything else. You know, ultimately, a lot of the diners have the incredible sense of entitlement is actually the reports I'm hearing the most, that, you know, they get really angry when you ask them to wear masks, when they get up to go to the bathroom, you know, use anything like that. They're not tipping very well. I mean, obviously tipping is a very questionable and terrible system in my opinion, but it is the current system and people are tipping less than ever. When they should be tipping, you know, 30% at least for people taking, you know, risks with their lives to serve you this, like, margarita.
Sure.
People are upset at wait times. They're writing, like, terrible Yelp reviews. I've heard complaints from servers where, customers have threatened to call the cops before on the restaurant. They're, you know, laughing in their face, like when they're asked to do anything, you know, hearing things like, oh, we can't wait for you guys to like shut down in like 6 months because of these rules. So it's wow. not great out there. Yeah.
So I've been out to eat a couple of times, but I've only sat outside. Are you, Kushbu, are you personally comfortable returning to indoor dining? Are you going to go eat inside?
Not at all. Like 100% no, which is, it's crazy. You know, my job very much depends on restaurants. It's centered on restaurants and I'm not comfortable whatsoever. I just don't think I can, you know, consciously risk someone else's life. Yeah. Even if I'm willing to risk my own, which I'm also not, I don't know why people are pretending this pandemic is over. It's far from, you know, you're still seeing the number of cases rise, even in New York City, which has taken a lot of precautions. And the cases are continuing, you know, again to surge right now. So
what about you, Carlos? Are you comfortable going to eat inside in Miami right now?
I haven't dined inside a restaurant in 6 months and I don't have plans to do it at any time soon.
You've been eating outside and how's that going?
I've been eating outside dining. and doing mostly takeout. Mostly I've been ordering from a lot of different places, trying to stay on top of what different restaurants are doing, what they're pivoting to try to stay relevant, to stay in business. But you know, I'm not, I think they don't want to put people at risk and I don't want to put myself at risk.
And do you agree with Kushbu that we need to be tipping more? Do you have a recommendation on how much we should be tipping servers?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, Kushbu's right. The tipping is the worst system that we have for paying people. I mean, I think if you're not tipping 25% on anything, especially now, I think you're doing a disservice to the people who are putting themselves in danger for you.
So Kushbu and Carlos, we've also been talking to our listeners about this, and some of them, like this one, told us they weren't ready to go back.
This is Diana Cruz from Edwardsville, Illinois, and I don't think I will be having any indoor dining soon. I just don't feel comfortable that even with enough social distancing that I can be protected. And so I definitely will not be participating in that for quite some time.
And meanwhile, we also reached out to folks who run restaurants to see how they're feeling about it. I want to play you a few of those calls.
My name is Greg Keenan. I'm calling from Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. And I'm a restaurant owner. I'm 68 years old, so I guess you'd call me part of the risk group. But I haven't felt that way. From the get-go, I wore a mask. And from the get-go, everyone who works here wears a mask all the time they work here. And we've put plexiglass up between booths and tables. We obviously practice social distancing. And we're very clear with guests that when they get up from that table, they have to have a mask on when they have to have a mask on to get to the table. So we think we've minimized risk.
My name is Susanna Cotine. I am the owner of Lido Restaurant on Frederick Douglass Boulevard and the corner of 117th Street in Harlem, Manhattan. I'm thrilled to be able to welcome our guests back to the restaurant. Of course, I do understand that this has to be a gradual process to keep the staff and the guests safe. But in New York, we've just been allowed 25% capacity, as well as to take over some space in the parking lanes. So during a very difficult time with COVID, we had to invest in structures to allow our guests to sit outside. And then the city is also allowing us to keep these structures throughout the winter, which means that we'll have to invest more to enclose and heat them.
My name is Mark Jamison. I have two restaurants, one in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, one in Lehigh County, Pennsylvania. Both are old stone colonial hotels. We're petrified. We talk about improving ventilation systems. We don't even have ventilation systems. We heat with radiators. We're going to get locked in the next week or two. Although Pennsylvania has been very safe, thanks to Governor Wolf, and our area is not a hot spot anymore. All it takes is one person to come in, and we're all just sitting ducks in there, truly. We're scared to death.
Kushbu, let's talk about the money. How much is the gradual shift back to indoor dining helping these restaurants financially?
You know, I understand that restaurants, you know, are really desperate right now. They're in such dire straits. But I'm not sure that indoor dining is necessarily going to pay off, you know, it's going to ultimately help their bottom line more. A lot of the upgrades that they're required to do, or the upgrades that, you know, they should be doing to help their customers feel more safe, are expensive. You know, that restaurant owner just mentioned putting up plexiglass. I've heard reports of different restaurant owners paying upwards of $3,000 to $5,000 just to put up plexiglass in their restaurants. Air purifiers cost a lot of money. You know, they have to provide masks and other PPE type equipment to their servers and to their other staff members. Like, these things add up, especially when the money isn't coming in as it used to. And I'm not sure at 25% capacity, especially in New York City, where a lot of restaurants are, you know, teeny tiny, and like 25% yeah. capacity maybe means six diners at once, you know, max, is really going to help their bottom line ultimately.
Yeah, that's why some restaurants are implementing time limits where you have to leave at a certain time, which sort of takes away a lot of the enjoyment of going out to eat. Carlos, Miami is such a great restaurant town. How big of a hit have restaurants there taken? Have there been a lot of closures?
Yeah, it's hard to put a number on how many closures we've seen, because some places did close kind of with the hope of reopening at some point in the future. I think, you know, the summers in Miami are slow to begin with. So it's really going to be interesting to see what happens in the next couple months. Because honestly, outdoor dining doesn't get really nice here until right around now, right then, in about the next 2 weeks. So yeah. The places and Miami, I will say, has done a really good job at making it easy for places to make room for dining. In other words, turning parking spaces into seating areas. Closing off parts of streets, Miami Beach did, to allow places for people to sit. And so we'll see. We'll see if this really is a solution for them, because, like I said, most folks want to sit outside in the next couple months. And so this might play into giving them a little bit of a lifeline.
Yeah. In terms of a lifeline, Kushbu, do you think there's any kind of support that the federal government could be offering to restaurants right now?
I mean, I think that's honestly the only thing that's going to ultimately bail out the restaurant industry is help at a government level. There is a bill that's going through the House again that does call for help for small businesses, especially the restaurant industry. And, you know, people are really hopeful that this will pass. I think it's the first time that restaurants have actually banded together to form a lobbying group besides the National Restaurant Association. And the National Restaurant Association tends to represent a lot of chain restaurants. So this is the first time you're seeing more independent restaurants, you know, band together to have a lobbying voice in the government. So they're hopeful, you know, that this might pass. I'm not so sure it will.
Sure. Yeah, like anything in Washington, it's a question mark. Kushbu, are there innovations in the meantime that restaurants are implementing that in order to help them during this time, but that might stick around long term?
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of cool, like, cocktail to go programs. You know, I hope that cities keep adjusting their liquor laws to, you know, allow for this. I think it's a way that restaurants are actually able to make a lot of money on takeout and delivery, is to be able to still have that alcohol upcharge with the takeout options. Restaurants are serving cool meal kits that people can take home and still have, you know, the restaurant experience. They're pairing them with videos of, like, the chef making the dish. So there's kind of like an interactive experience. People are doing really cool. You're seeing a lot of innovations too, of like people selling food through Instagram, like former actual restaurant workers. So a lot of former pastry chefs, just former line cooks, like selling restaurant quality food through Instagram. Wow. Thanks to cottage laws. So you can get like really high-end pastries from like the former pastry chef at Gramercy Tavern, you know, on Sundays in Queens. Like, they do a pastry box, you know, for, I think it's $50. And it's like a whole assortment of pastries that are seriously high-end. And it's cool to see, you know, these types of businesses pop up.
Sure. Yeah. And that could stick around long past this pandemic. Carlos, we got about a minute left. I'm just curious how your job as a food editor for the Miami Herald, how some of the reporters who cover restaurants, how their job has just totally changed during this pandemic.
Well, I think it's changed the focus away from food criticism, which I'm happy about. I like to write about stories that are very Miami-centric. In other words, stories that could only happen here. So you have stories like Kushbu was saying about, you know, a guy who was the head chef at one of our top restaurants down here, Q, who started, it's like an Asian barbecue place, who started his own little barbecue spot out in front of his house, you know, and taking orders through Instagram. We have a guy who had a successful seafood restaurant, but he said nobody wants to order limp seafood delivered in 30 to 45 minutes. So he turned it into a classic Italian-American red sauce place, more comfort food, things that can reheat well. So I think we're seeing the most creativity out of restaurant owners and food people. And that's really been the most interesting, encouraging part. And the most interesting thing to document.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that is getting me quite hungry. I appreciate it, guys. Kushbu Shah is Food & Wine Magazine's restaurant editor, and Carlos Frias is the food editor for the Miami Herald. Thank you to you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Congress has passed a law that will ban TikTok. But why?
If you are going to take away an app used by 170 million people, I believe that lawmakers and the government, who ostensibly work for us, the American people, owe us more information about why that divestiture is being moved forward.
Debating the TikTok ban. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega. Since the pandemic started, experts have warned that it could reverse two decades of progress in the global fight against child labor. According to the United Nations, at least 24 million children around the world will likely drop out of school. Millions of those children will be pushed into the workforce to support their families as economic fallout from the pandemic continues. For more on this, we're joined now by Joe Becker, Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be with you, Matt.
It's good to have you. So what do we know about rates of child labor globally since this pandemic started?
Well, we know that they are increasing across the globe. There are several reasons why COVID-19 is having such a big impact on child labor. One, obviously, is just what's happening economically due to the pandemic. Families are under huge economic stress. Many have lost their jobs or their income. And that creates a lot of pressure on parents to send their children to work to meet their basic needs. UNICEF has estimated that since the pandemic began, an additional 150 million children have fallen into poverty. And when poverty rates rise, so does child labor. A second element is what's happening with schools, the massive school shutdowns around the globe. Hundreds of millions of kids are out of school, and many don't have access to the internet or online learning. So that leaves them with little to do, and they see work as the best alternative. A third factor is the rising mortality rate. Globally, we have more than 34 million COVID-19 cases, over a million deaths. And a big driver of child labor is when a parent falls sick, becomes disabled, or dies. Then children often become the breadwinners for the family. We saw this during the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, when orphans ended up trafficked in sexual exploitation or other forms of child labor. And then finally, we have less enforcement of child labor laws. COVID-19 precautions mean that many labor inspectors aren't doing active inspections. So child labor is likely to go undetected, and employers are less worried about getting caught.
You mentioned Africa. Are there certain regions of the world that are more vulnerable than others to seeing this kind of uptick in child labor right now?
Asia and Africa would be two of the regions that we'd be most concerned about. Africa has one of the highest rates, and Asia has, just in terms of raw numbers, some of the largest numbers of child laborers. So it's certainly a concern everywhere.
What kind of jobs are kids around the world doing now that, for all these factors that you mentioned earlier that are driving them into the workforce, what kind of work are they actually doing?
The largest number are in agriculture. But others are working in mining and brick kilns. They're working as street vendors, picking through trash heaps, looking for items to sell. Just yesterday, the U.S. Department of Labor put out a new report, and they find that the goods that are most often made with child labor include gold, bricks, sugarcane, coffee, and tobacco.
I imagine some of these jobs and some of these goods are connected to consumer demand from places like the U.S., right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that consumers need to think about is, you know, when they buy products, is there a possibility that they've been made with child labor?
I've seen some reporting on children dropping out of schools in the U.S. as well. Do we know if there's any shifts in child labor rates here?
Well, yeah, child labor isn't just an issue in other countries. It is a problem in the United States, primarily in agriculture. There are exemptions in U.S. labor law that allows children to work in agriculture at much younger ages, for longer hours, and under much more hazardous conditions than in any other industry. So children, a 12-year-old child in the U.S. can work 40 or 50 hours a week in the fields, and it's perfectly legal. And agriculture is surprisingly dangerous. There are more child workers in the U.S. who die in agriculture than any other industry. Every day, 33 children are injured working on U.S. farms. Adult farm workers make very little money in the U.S., and so that creates pressure to take their children into the fields. And now, with many U.S. schools closed, the fact that this work is legal creates an additional pull to bring more children into that kind of work.
So do we know that there are more kids now in the fields doing work instead of going to school?
Well, unfortunately, we have very little data. All the information that we have is pretty much anecdotal. But, you know, it's certainly a logical outcome of the different factors that we see in the U.S. right now.
What kind of interventions from governments or the UN are we seeing right now to try to address this issue?
Well, one big intervention that's needed is guaranteed monthly income for poor families. You know, they need support to meet their basic needs without resorting to child labor. And one of the lessons of the last 20 years is that cash transfer programs were one of the biggest factors in reducing child labor rates because it did protect those vulnerable families from economic crisis. So, you know, one important thing is that governments continue to provide this kind of financial relief to the most vulnerable families. A second thing is, you know, education. We know that children who are in school are much less likely to enter the workforce. So whether it's in person or online, you know, children need to have access to schooling. If it's safe to reopen schools, that's great. But if not, governments need to ensure full access to the internet and online learning so that kids don't fall behind.
And if they have classes to go to even online, then they won't be working and their schools could be keeping track of them, I imagine.
Exactly. And as schools reopen, they really need to be very proactive in reaching out to make sure that children are coming back. You know, as you noted in your introduction, there are 24 million children that are estimated to have dropped out permanently. They may never return. And so there really needs to be outreach efforts to make sure that children are, you know, kept in the educational system. Yeah.
Joe Becker is the Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Joe, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The pandemic has created one of the worst recessions in American history. Millions of people have lost their jobs, and small business owners throughout the country have been forced to close their doors. But in a twist of financial irony, reports show that the wealthiest people in the country have only grown richer since the pandemic began, while the economic crisis continues to devastate middle class and low-income households. According to a study by Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies, billionaires in the U.S. from mid-March through early August grew their wealth by $637 billion, potentially stretching the wealth gap to unprecedented levels. Joining us now to talk about how this happened is Dion Rabowin, the markets editor at Axios and the writer of the Axios Markets newsletter. Dion, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Matt, thanks so much for having me.
So tell me about the types of companies and the billionaires that have made the most money during this pandemic. Who are they and is there a commonality about them?
The people who have benefited most as this pandemic has hit have been the CEOs, the owners of tech companies. You know, the big names that stand out, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, they've seen the biggest benefit. But really, this has been all about a larger divergence between the wealthy and the poor. So really, anyone who has wealth has prospered and who has publicly available stock or who owns a company that trades on a public stock exchange has done pretty well. I guess it's not everyone, but by and large, if you've got money, you've done quite well during this pandemic.
And is this just how things tend to work during recessions, that the super rich just can grow their wealth? How does this compare to like the recession in 2008?
No, this is actually very unusual. Back in 2008 and in most recessions, what typically happens is everyone in the country kind of feels it at the beginning. What happened and what's different about this recession from 2008, the great financial crisis, or the global financial crisis and the great recession, is that what would normally happen over a period of years, and what happened over about 11 or 12 years from the Great Recession to about 2019, has happened in the span of just about 6 months for the wealthy. So the wealthy have seen a kind of bounce back in their fortunes from the end of March to September that was about what you'd expect to see over a decade horizon, while the poor folks and folks without any kind of financial assets have really seen their position just continue to slide. And it's actually been worse because we've seen about four times the number of job losses, and those jobs aren't coming back at the speed that we lost them or anywhere near that.
And I understand billionaires have also benefited from the Paycheck Protection Program, which was part of the CARES Act that was meant to help small businesses stay afloat during the pandemic. How has that happened? How have they gotten a piece of that pie?
Yeah, the Paycheck Protection Plan was a well-intentioned program through the CARES Act, which Congress rushed through to try and get money out to people as quickly as possible. One thing they didn't put in place was a lot of protections or restrictions on who could get the money. As a result of that, a lot of these savvy businesses took advantage of the designation of, you know, a small business, because a small business is really only defined by how many people work for it. It doesn't matter how much money you make. As a result of the environment we're in, a lot of big companies can make a lot of money without a lot of employees, and they were able to get some of this money from the PPP, and then they were able to use that to pay employees, and they were able to go to the debt markets, borrow money, and use that money to basically enrich shareholders or enrich executives and themselves.
Why is this happening? Why are the rich getting so rich right now?
You can really point to one culprit, and that's the Federal Reserve. They came in and took unprecedented, tremendous action in March, launching this program that folks in the market have called QE Infinity or QE Forever. Basically, the Fed has this program called quantitative easing, and what they do is they buy bonds, and it's largely government bonds or mortgage-backed securities. But what they did this time was they said they're buying an unlimited amount, literally no cap on it. We'll buy as much as we possibly can or as much as needed, is what they said. And in addition, they bought corporate bonds. So they would buy the debt from companies like Apple or Verizon, literally trillion-dollar companies. The Fed went in and said, we will buy their debt. What that did is it created this risk-on environment in markets where if you were a trader or if you were an investor, you were willing to buy any kind of risky asset, and that's stocks and some of these high yield or junk bonds, because you were convinced that the Fed had your back and that there was really no risk involved in buying some of these companies that may have been shaky, or, you know, buying stocks that generally is considered a risky investment. So that pushed stock prices up. We've seen a rise of about 60% on the NASDAQ, about 50% on the S&P 500, an increase in stock prices at levels you've never seen, pushing these companies to all-time highs and stock prices to all-time highs at a time when the actual economy, the real economy, is hurting and really has kind of stalled out over the past couple months.
Do other countries handle recessions in similar ways by giving massive influxes of money to profitable companies and then dumping cash into the markets?
Yes and no. I think what's happened with the Fed, they've taken it to an extreme that no other central bank has, and really just massively blown up this new central bank ecosystem. But the process of quantitative easing, of bond buying, is actually being used by just about every central bank in the world. The European Central Bank has done this, and they've actually pushed interest rates around the Eurozone to negative, so about negative 0.5%. I know it sounds crazy, but interest rates can actually be negative, meaning that if you are trying to hold money at the European Central Bank, you pay them rather than them paying you. So there's all kinds of sort of crazy monetary tricks being used around the world to help try to stimulate the economies of the world that have just not gotten any natural growth. We're living in what I've called a number of times the make-believe economy, an economy that's just being stood up by a bunch of central bank funny money, which is literally money they create out of thin air and then use to buy a government debt. And the Fed is now using to buy the debt of trillion-dollar companies like Apple.
So are there any efforts by either the public sector or private sector to just change the way this country handles economic crises to prevent the Fed and companies from doing these financial shenanigans in future recessions?
It's sad to say no. There's been pushback, right? There's been a kind of blowback to this, and you see it with the rise of politicians like Donald Trump and like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, folks who say that the system is broken, the system is rigged, the capitalism isn't working. And you're likely going to see more of that as more and more people see that this system isn't working. But because most people don't understand how the Federal Reserve works or what it does or what's actually going on with the economy, they really don't know who to blame or what to blame or what's even happening or why this situation is occurring. They just know that it feels unfair and it feels like it's not right.
Dion Rabowin, markets editor at Axios and writer of the Axios Markets newsletter. Dion, thanks so much for explaining this all to us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show, guys. Thanks for having me. I always enjoy stopping by The Takeaway. I want to give a quick shout out to the team who puts the show together each day. Our board operators are Vince Fairchild and Debbie Daughtry. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Line producing was Jackie Martin. Alexandra Boti and Amber Hall are our senior producers. And the producer crew is Jose Olivetas, Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, and Jason Tureski. A very special thanks to Lydia McMullen-Laird, who is moving on after a great tenure on The Takeaway. Lydia, this team will miss you a ton. Polly Arungu is our digital editor, David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is the executive producer. Please keep calling in and sharing your stories with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-865-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Amy Walter is in tomorrow, and Tanzina is back on Monday. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway.